Welcome to Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com for May 15th, 2006. I'm Rob Greenlee again here, joined along with Dana Greenlee.
Hi, folks.
And we have another guest in here, too.
Yes, not just the two of us.
Mitch Radcliffe.
Hello.
Hello.
Try you
Welcome
will not?
Welcome again, Mitch.
Try I will to play along.
Dana is a boston-legal.org website maintainer, content creator extraordinaire.
Goddess.
That's right. And she's also the host of the Boston Legal Podcast, which she does religiously.
Podcast Goddess.
And for hours and hours of content in her podcast. Actually, I think you're the only podcaster I know that creates two parts to your podcast.
They're long ones. We're talking 90-minute podcasts.
Long-winded, I should say. And Mitch is a rational ranter? Is that what you are?
Agitator.
I just speak the truth.
Uh-huh.
Not that everybody agrees that it is the truth, but that's...
Well, it's your truth.
That's their problem, not mine.
It's the truthiness of the matter that he brings up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Speak from the gut and the brain.
And
so I'm a rational ranter.
He is a rational ranter for ZDNet, and it's part of ZDNet's blogger program at blogs.zdnet.com/Radcliffe/, right? But it might be easier to go to Google and maybe type in rational ranter.
No, I think actually rational rants might bring it up, but I would probably just go to blogs.zdnet.com.
That'd probably be a good idea. And you also,
if you type my name in, you don't see that first. You see other stuff.
Really? It doesn't come up to the top? I mean, so what's the first thing that comes up in Google when you type your name in now?
My website.
Your Radcliffe blog.
Radcliffe blog probably comes up first. I don't know, something like that.
Mitch is wearing an Iron Chef t-shirt, and we want to know why.
Because I used to play Chairman Kaga on the Japanese show.
So do a little voice action for us for that?
No.
Okay.
Because I'm under a contractual obligation.
Oh, it's a copyrighted thing,
yeah.
Huh? Okay.
I can only do that then.
Okay. Well, we should probably run down some of the main topics that we're going to cover, right, Dana?
That's right.
Is Yahoo regretting not buying Google?
I think the answer is clearly yes.
Aww. Yes.
Little equation for you. How about if you add older online users plus online social networks plus user behavior? What do you get? Next area of online growth?
Could very well be.
And we're going to ask whether or not influence is the most valuable currency online.
And what is the potential for social digital media? We're going to discuss that. And
if you want to discuss stuff with us, well, we can always be reached at, rob@webtalkradio.com, dana@webtalkradio.com. Mitch, do you want to jump in there with an email address?
godsdog@ratcliffe.com.
And he is God's dog. We are also proud members of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. And the network has a bunch of other technology podcasts. Go check them out. They got a brand new site up there that's got a lot of interesting things going on. They got,
I'm here right now, and there's tech everywhere.
Yes, it's gushing out all over the table. And we can also be heard on Mobilecast at mobilecast.com. Just drop the E, and you can get the show on your mobile phone. So it's kind of interesting.
Drop the E?
Drop the E from mobile.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it's like it's the old gas company.
Yeah, company. Exactly.
Okay.
It's okay.
The gas company. I hear something.
I couldn't make that mental connection.
Petrochemical producer.
Oh, okay.
Do you guys hear the sound, the mournful wailing off in the distance coming closer?
Yeah, well, it's because we're close to the sound here.
Oh, right? No.
The Puget Sound.
I think we're talking about that Yahoo guy.
Oh, that's true. He's a little bit regretful, I think, of not doing a deal
do you
in the
mean
past.
Mr. Terry Semel.
That's who I'm referring to. Yes, yes. He was asked the dumbest decision that he made since he took the job at Yahoo here recently. I guess
in 2001.
Well, since 2001, I guess.
He was recently asked.
Yeah,
he was recently asked.
Yes, yes.
And he didn't take the job recently.
No, that's true. That's true. I think
it's
I had that
commas.
Backwards. I had that backwards, didn't I?
Sentence structure.
But he actually...
what is the subject?
Had an opportunity.
The object of this sentence?
So I'll tell you, the verb is move on.
He had the opportunity to buy Google, and I guess at one point he had an opportunity to buy it for $1 billion. But I guess Larry Page and Sergey Brin kind of said, nah, they don't want to sell. And
I think the underlying message repeatedly, as Semel tells the story, is, no, we don't really want to sell.
Well,
just kept raising the price.
Well, so they kept bidding him up, yeah, exactly. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, back then, you know, $3 billion to those guys probably would have been a fairly attractive thing if they really, if Simmel was really serious pursuing them.
I think, though, that if after the second time when he came back and said, okay, we'll give you $1 billion, and they said, it's really $3 billion and we still don't want to sell, that I would have, and I've been in negotiations like this where I would have said, you know, that's a great idea, guys, and thank you very much. Don't let the door hit you on the ass on the way out.
You hate being manipulated and conned.
No, it's not even manipulated and conned. It's like, okay, you're just playing with me to see whether or not I'll continue to raise the bid.
And buy dinner.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that. Because a dinner and, you know, these Hollywood guys can be $1 billion all by itself.
It's true. It's true. And who knows if he would have kept
the... We have the blood of a child here for you. Drink deeply of the blood of the child.
Is that your Iron Chef voice?
No.
No, it wasn't. That was the evil twin voice.
That was the evil Terry Semel voice.
But you never know. It could have gone up to $6 billion or something and become another Broadcast.com deal, right?
Yeah, and the thing is that the Broadcast.com deal wasn't worth the... It was $5.3 billion, yeah. I believe, but the... Wasn't worth one penny of it, and I think Semel probably was thinking in the back of his mind, well, I don't want to do that again.
Exactly. I think that's what really was
behind this. Tim Kugel made that deal. I don't want to be the Tim Kugel of 2006.
Even though,
yet, in some strange way, he is the Tim Kugel of 2006.
Well, and what's also interesting about this, too,
is Yahoo CEO's in trouble.
Well, he's a Yahoo anyway, so, right? But anyway, what's interesting about this is if Google had sold to Yahoo, what would have happened to Google? It probably would have not achieved its level of success that we see today.
Yeah, probably. But you know, the thing is, its level of success today is churning out a lot of half-assed features, calling them products, and hoping that, you know, they get a little more traffic out of it. And I don't see Google doing all the spectacular stuff that people say it does.
It's just because it's in our pop culture vernacular, we just feel like we love it so much. It's doing more than, you know, it's perception versus reality.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is they're becoming more like Microsoft every day?
Yeah.
Is that essentially what you're saying?
I think that they reached a critical mass in terms of search a number of quarters ago. And now when you see Yahoo Desktop coming out and just getting to be more and more a form of bloatware that doesn't really do anything except tell Google about your searches, that's not a really compelling business model from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, it increases your ability to target ads better, and it's a pretty nifty thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a point where the value to the user has to exceed the value to the company, and I think they've already passed that.
Well, certainly search is the core of what they do that they make money on, and all these other things are kind of like distractions from that, it seems like, somewhat.
Yeah, and yet the revenue has nothing to do with search per se. It has to do with ad placement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
But there's a fundamental dichotomy within the company, a veritable battle.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say so.
It's a dialectic is what it is.
A dialectic. Wow.
Well, let's move on and talk a little about the new wave in social networking out there, I think, is going to evolve into a little bit more of a behavioral targeting area, you know, and you combine that with more everyday users, like maybe older users.
I think old people is a pretty good market to be in.
You think so?
Yeah.
Are you being facetious?
No, seriously. Think about the number of old people there are going to be and how much longer they're going to live on average than old people used to.
So you mean old people 2.0, like in the next 10 years?
Old people, well, if you think of
because those are the better
boomers.
Old people.
if you think of baby boomers.
Then those decrepit 1.0 old people that have put up with for the last 20 years.
Because I'm thinking about my parents, and they're not into social networking. You know, it's TV and farm.
I think it depends on how old, right?
Well, but your parents aren't boomers, are they?
No.
We're boomers.
So you're talking about us.
We're tail-end boomers, though.
Well, we're tail-end boomers.
Yeah, and in fact, I would guess that Dana is not even a tail-end boomer.
Yeah, she is.
No, I am. I'm a 1960 person.
She was...
Oh, okay.
She's actually older than I am.
I'm older than you,
Good
too.
Lord.
I'm older than everybody in this room, right?
Wow, I've just had some sort of cognitive thing here.
He just likes to flatter the women.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, yeah. So anyway...
But you look so young.
I mean, there's all these social networking sites out there that are all gathering profiles, right? On
everything.
On early adopters, primarily tech geeks, younger people.
Kind of like what the NSA is doing.
younger.
It's MySpace.
Teenagers.
MySpace
that kind of
a phenomenon, but it's definitely happening across a broad range of demographic groups in the population.
But
I have a mother-in-law who 2 years ago didn't use a computer and now uses Match.com every day and uses MSNBC and all the other things that she uses to keep up. So I mean, even though your parents aren't 2.0, they may become 2.0.
No, they very well could.
If your mother-in-law, Match.com?
Yeah, which is, I find, particularly ironic since I helped fund Match.com.
Yeah, that is true.
But yeah, no, seriously.
She's dating?
I guess it's dating if it's, social get-togethers. Uh-huh. I don't think that, she's hooking up.
Pretty calling.
But you never know, right?
Yeah, I think knowing my mother-in-law pretty seriously. No, that's not what she's doing.
Okay.
But, and Sharon, if you hear this, I'm sorry. But
she's probably not, right?
But no, I mean, you see as social functionality gets integrated into the net more thoroughly, which maybe 2.0 or maybe just, 1.5, that more and more people are just naturally drawn into these conversational environments rather than the sort of arbitrary, I have a function I want to accomplish. I should use that internet thing that used to predominate in society. So, it's like we were talking about Google. They're about search, right? Well, you need to find something, you go Google it. But what we're talking about now is that I have a whole bunch of connections that I have to maintain with other people through the internet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different kind of a modality. Is that clicking actually coming out of my mouth?
I think it's your sunglasses, actually.
Is it? Good. Because I thought for a minute I'd either become one of those African click speakers or some form of insect.
Yeah.
And
I was thinking about the insect.
I was too, because I was thinking, God, I'm morphing right now.
Well, no, I think you're...
It's the bugs in the computer.
Your sunglasses were like a form of wing, the wing that pats.
Oh, they were they were chitinous. So anyway, that's what's happening. And so now then you get to what you're talking about, which is behavioral ad placement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that – I mean,
like that segue from the chitinous behavioral ad placement.
That was really slick.
Because, in a way, we're all insect-like now.
Yes, we are.
We're social insects.
Yes, we are. Yeah. Well, but that's only a piece of it. I mean, this whole behavioral targeting thing, that's more of a business thing, in a more targeted way of – delivering advertising, which might be the next generation of search too, but that's kind of that's a whole nother discussion. But I guess what I wanted to focus on was the older online users, are they going to get engaged in these social networks, and do these social networks need to be different somehow appeal to those people?
They need to be appropriate to their needs.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean they need to be functionally different. I mean, it could be like MySpace, but without hip-hop embedded music.
It could be other types of
pictures of my grandchildren.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
And it probably just needs to be simpler and easier to understand. Or is there...
Or it has to be more purposeful.
More purposeful. I think
that's the thing.
That's good.
Here's one of the things that's going to happen. I mean, you can see it demographically, is there's a lot of people who are never going to be able to retire. So to the degree that social networking can enable them to continue to earn some form of income, they'll be driven to do that.
Yeah, well, that
interesting and scary idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you think
and
about
solution.
LinkedIn,
all of a sudden it's not a funny conversation anymore, is it?
No, it's like survival. There are social networks out there that are serving a more of an adult purpose out there. If you think of LinkedIn and you think of there's a new site that's popping up that was funded in connection with National Public Radio called Gather.com. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be focusing on kind of the older and wiser generations, just like what you're saying, right along the lines as a MySpace, but it's more of an enlightened social network.
Well, I think you're just discounting the qualities that children bring to the net.
Well,
I've been looking at MySpace, and I'm stunned
I think
by
it's different.
How gratuitously self-indulgent it is. But, I don't think that grown-ups will be any different, frankly.
Well,
I know. Now I sound like some high and mighty intellectual type who thinks.
It's basically a social pickup joint for teens. I mean, that's what MySpace at its core
really
is.
Yeah, and telling everybody that you're going to kill everyone at high school.
Yeah, well, that's a small percentage.
I don't really think of it that way. But it's stunning to me. It's stunning. Well, no, because it actually happened over at the
I mean, it's happened.
The high school where, you know, I mean, well, my wife teaches.
And so. There's all these predators that are.
Yeah. Where she taught? I remember that.
Well, she actually taught the. He was a graduate of the junior high. She's taught it.
Wow.
But anyway, but the thing is, you know, MySpace is an interesting and strange place that reflects a teenage mentality. And we're going to see interesting and strange places from our perspective, 2.0 places, where suddenly our parents seem to be engaged. And we're going to go, oh, my God. I mean, you know, it's not grandma's hooking up, but it's going to be grandma has this whole life and I don't know anything about it. I mean, when I come home and my mother-in-law is sitting there ardently engaged with her computer.
Wow.
You know,
because like you say, you have to keep connected to your 15 friends that you only know via online.
Or you know them the rest of the time, you know, in the physical world, and it's part of your travel itinerary. Because when you think about older folks with their travel, you know, they go on these cruises and stuff, you're going to see people who become, you know, clusters of friends who are virtual 9 months out of the year and then that's 3 months out of the year. They may go do stuff together.
That's so cool. I like that idea. Speaking of social networking, Orkut, man, I mean, which you brought to my consciousness three, four years ago. Yeah. What a mess that's become.
Yeah, that's useless.
It's it's all like Brazilian guys trying to find girls, you know? And that's
Well, and that's that's the majority of what social networking is today. I mean,
I don't agree.
There's
a lot of different functionality in social networking. It's just when you look at it, you know, the pictures of the cleavage and the abs stand out. You know, but I mean, if you look at the whole thing, you know, because you sometimes have to really spend some time on these sites, and it's incredibly tedious in a lot of ways if it isn't your thing.
Yeah.
And you start seeing that there are other patterns emerging about interaction and community growth that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's easy to discount MySpace because, you know, a 12-year-old girl posed nude or something and everybody talks about that.
Well,
but that's not what MySpace is
about. It's also in the media right now. There's a lot of attention around predators and in relation to MySpace. But it's also
– we got to teach our kids to recognize that and not fall for it. Rather,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
My kids play Warcraft a lot.
Yeah, I totally
agree. My daughter, you know, who's 10 years old, has an extensive ignore list of people who just barely even stepped over the line that she's drawn for herself. And she just says, I ignore her. You know, that guy – And she finds people who are really into the game, and they block out anybody who doesn't, you know, follow the rules.
Yeah, I totally agree. My own daughter does that as well. I mean, when she's online, we've talked about it a lot. Mm-hmm. She can tell posers, and she can tell people that are not authentic very quickly.
She can tell if somebody's a dog on the internet.
Yeah.
See, that's 2.0. On the internet, nobody could tell. On 2.0,
everybody can tell.
And it's like a technological form of clicks, too. You know, this is my little click, and you're not getting in.
And they're evolving a whole set of social skills that, you know, would have been alien to us at their age. But that's also happening with our parents.
Plus, one other little twist to this, if we think about the wiser and the older adults, I guess, if we are wiser than the young people, I'm not quite sure entirely. But
all of us, Rob.
I know. Is the potential there for the social networks to be developed into areas where important discussion takes place about important world issues, local issues, that you and me and Dana and all the listeners that we have listening to this program can engage in helping shape maybe public policy, maybe who gets elected. I mean,
My experience with that, having been involved in a lot of online organizing efforts and more importantly, from my perspective, in terms of judging this, writing about those issues and being systematically attacked by people who want to paint me into a particular box and then just say, well, now we can dismiss him. The political discourse of the time is not friendly to that kind of collaborative discussion. And that would need to change. And I don't see the tools in and of themselves changing that behavior because that has to do with I've experienced this week with a posting about the NSA call database. The response to me was not, you know, oh, that's an interesting point, but you're wrong about this and that. It was to change the topic and say that I did it because I hated Bush or I was a liberal or whatever. And, you know, it's pointless.
That's clearly an unenlightened view.
Well, some of those people were enlightened, and some of them combined arguing the point with abuse.
Yeah.
And yet they were also arguing with misinformation about my point. So I think we have to change a lot in order to make that happen. You know, mm-hmm. that's a set of skills that all of us are evolving collectively at this point, and we haven't gotten anywhere near achieving.
Yeah, and then the other major piece, I think, as we think about these social networks is the content creation piece, and that also applies to blogs, podcasting, video blogging, all those phenomenons, that people are contributing content, they're recording, they're documenting, they're taking pictures, they're commenting. It just, you know, it just feels like that's the direction that this is all going, is mm-hmm. that all of us become involved more in areas that are of interest to us. And we all become influencers to whatever level of degree, and mm-hmm. this is kind of a segue into the next thing we're going to talk mm-hmm. about, that we all kind of have our place of influence.
We all have our place of influence, but what we have to do is simultaneously develop a tolerance for people who don't share our ideas in order for our influence to be more effective, because it's when you can meld contradictory communities mm-hmm. with separate issues and separate interests into coalitions that you create real power politically and within the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of technology, what kind of process do we have to get into in order to achieve that level of being able to protect people from being attacked? Is that, you know, I know, Dana, you've done quite a bit with your forum, with your Boston Legal website.
Yeah, how do you deal with people who are abusive on the site?
Isn't it amazing? And I was the scaredest thing, you know, scared that wouldn't happen. And actually, it hasn't happened. I think I put enough warnings and goals in my rules area that people, when people do kind of go outside the lines, I post it so everybody can see, you know, my rebuttal, and then I delete them. So maybe people just pick that up.
So you think the community is self-policing?
Yeah, I do. And I think that because people who read it, read the other, we have really intelligent people talking in there. No one wants to be the standout jerk. You know, I think everybody just, because everybody treats each other so politely with the majority.
Okay, so there's a purpose. And that purpose is what's defining whether or not you're out of bounds. And that is, we're here to talk about Boston Legal and to talk about it, you know, as real fans and connoisseurs.
Well, and Dana set the ground rules for that at the
right.
beginning of this
show. I said no
show.
Political discussions, because that digresses the worst. You know,
right.
And yes, Boston Legal's 50% about politics and slamming the administration. That's all right. We can talk about that storyline, but do not make your opinion known.
Right.
I mean, that sounds horrible.
Right.
Right. But it's
worked.
But
the thing is that they then talk through the storylines and express their opinions through the storylines. And that keeps it on track. So you remember when we met and I was working with a certain Irish immigrant?
I do remember
were policing video chats. Remember
uh-huh.
that? Okay,
yeah,
so we had this business where we had basically beat cops who would watch video chat. And we watched all sorts of video chats, like yeah. feeding the elephants at the National Zoo and things like that.
Yeah.
And in that environment, there were people who would like to show up and drop their pants. And
still goes on today, I'm sure.
Still goes on today, I'm yeah. sure. But what yeah. happened, but we had these people who were watching, like, you know, 300 different video chat spaces, so that they would pop in, and they had the ability to drop people out, right, and say, you can't do that, you pervo. And well, what would happen is that the members of the community would first start calling the beat cop over to expel people, and then ultimately would just drive those people out by themselves. So that, because the purpose of the community was being defiled by the naked people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, you know, like places where naked people could go. Not to say that they didn't have a right to be naked. But the community became increasingly self-reinforcing, not self-policing, but they just, you know, this is why we're here. They constantly
yeah.
defined their purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And they redefined and focused that purpose as they had that interaction over time. And it was interesting to watch. You know, the business didn't go very far because of other extraneous
yeah,
issues. But
other, yeah.
That's a way of us putting it nicely.
So there's basically the opportunity for all these people to have their venues to do what they want to do. It's not necessarily censoring what people are doing. It's channeling it.
Channeling it, but then also recognizing that there's times when conflicting values have to come into a common environment mm-hmm. without destroying one another. And we have a tendency right now, politically, because that's the thing, is to destroy the other side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was at the bookstore right before I came over here, And in the current events section, it's books about how bad the left is and books about how bad the right is. And there's nothing about our common center, which is what defines American politics. It is about those awful people over there. Mm-hmm. And that's the mode of political discourse that we have that is
a
problem.
So is that temporary, do you think? Or is that a permanent characteristics of
it's
people?
It's cyclical.
No? Okay.
I think people go from the there's a critical mass at the extremes that drifts back to the center, mm-hmm. and that probably have 40 or 50, maybe their country have cycles, 70-year cycles. I don't know.
Ooh, that's a long really time to wait it. For the centrists to come out.
Well, but when was the last time there was really an American center?
I'm not sure.
But it hasn't been
really from probably 1954 to 1968 was the last time there was really an American center, which was Eisenhower and Kennedy declining through Johnson.
Okay.
So
now, when you say an American center, that means a majority view.
Majority view, where you had 60% electoral pluralities.
Mm-hmm. So in those type of environments, it's more likely to have landslides, kind of victories by political leaders.
But the thing is that you could have landslides by both parties. You could also say that we had it from 86 to 96.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's true. I think that at that point you still had a pretty deeply divided polity.
Yeah, that's true. And so anyway, let's talk a little bit about you blogged this past week on your ZDNet blog about influence. Mm-hmm. It's from what you said, what moves networked markets, and I know that there's been a lot of discussion about attention. There's been a lot of discussion about the attention economy is what's driving everything. But your contention in this blog post is that the ultimate currency is influence. That's at the cusp of when decisions are made.
Well, that's what drives decisions is our ability to take all the raw material of information and all the attention we pay to things and then translate that into an action which is conveyed to another person. And mm-hmm. that's what influence is basically.
So are we going to see influence become – I mean, I think we look out over a couple of years here. We're going to see influence become a major metric.
Well, I hope so. I mean,
gauging online participation.
You know, the disclosure is I help build a system that is going to express that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, obviously, I want that to happen. Mm-hmm. It's good for me financially, so everybody should take what I say with a grain of salt. But
is that where we're going? I think that's without you.
I think if I weren't doing this, I hope my doing it helps.
Sure.
Express this. But if you're looking at what do people do and create? How do they create value in the economy? Mm-hmm. Watching something or bookmarking something are two degrees of paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Social bookmarking something is yet another degree of paying attention where now you're expressing your idea into the world. But if you're doing that about a whole bunch of different stuff, you don't have the same influence on all those different topics because it's how you cultivate your expertise, just as we do in the normal economy, where we talk with one another. And when somebody says, I got a question about podcasting, I got to call Rob.
Mm-hmm.
That you have influence in the podcast community. If somebody were sitting and thinking, "Gosh, I got to fix my car," they're not going to think, "I got to call Rob." They're going to say, "I got to call Bob."
Mm-hmm. Bob, the auto guy.
Yeah. Now, so you both may have an interest in podcasting, but one of you has more influence. And so that is mm-hmm. reflective of the kind of roles that we play.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to try to measure all this stuff, you have to look at how people are actually building, sustaining their influence on topics and being able to make decisions happen in other people.
So is that a form, let me rephrase this, a new form of marketing or another way of looking at it? Or it almost
it
feels like
be applied in marketing.
Well, it almost feels like that's what marketing has been all about from day one. It's just that the online environment creates an opportunity to be able to quantify it.
Well, marketing is a kind of an artificial version of what people do between themselves. And it's a way to, during the mass media, it was a way to try to organize massive amounts of influence on people's decision-making. Mm-hmm. Today, in an environment where you've got a peered, deeply distributed world, influence is more like it used to be before organized marketing came along, where anybody, because they have a channel,
It's fragmented.
Can become an influencer, could become an influencer maybe for everyone in society that, you know, is as rare, is going to be as rare tomorrow as it is now or it was 30 years ago. But you can be an influencer for 50 people, 500 people, 50,000 people. And those kinds of people are the ones who are now, you know, in charge of the real shape of the economy, because the economy is becoming local again at the same time as it's becoming global. We have a locality defined by our shared interests. We have localities defined by our shared geographic position on the planet. We have all sorts of different kinds of localities now. So mass marketing was this kind of artificial transition point where, because you had to have hundreds of thousands of dollars to build a network of radio broadcast towers or to buy a printing press capable of producing 100,000 or a million papers
to reach large, those people.
So what's happening is influence is moving back to the edges. And that is, I think, something that is going to be measured. And, you know, clearly I think I have a way to measure it.
But is value still going to be derived primarily by media, whether it be online or a person's influence?
What's media?
Just media.
Communication?
Through human communications that's being passed through the network, whether it be a podcast, blog, whatever, reaching a large audience will always be more valuable than reaching a smaller audience. Or is the metrics of that going to change based on who that small audience is
versus... It depends on the value of a transaction.
Yeah.
And so you might have a very high transactional situation, like somebody deciding, somebody influencing other people to get expensive cosmetic surgery. Okay. Now, Dana could go out and say, you know, I'm going to get all sorts of cosmetic surgery. And everybody's going to say, Dana, you just look wonderful. You look like a mannequin now. I'm going to go get that. Well, and then she writes about it and photographs the changes that she's wrought upon herself. And everybody goes, wow, I want to be like Dana. Okay, now, only 10 people want to be like Dana, but every one of them is going to spend $15,000. Dana's worth something on a small scale to a certain group of plastic surgeons around here or around the world.
She is an influencer around plastic surgery, you know?
I did not know that.
You are. Because
you can't just leave that hanging. I haven't
you did a whole bunch of recordings for a local plastic surgery company that plays them on broadcast radio.
We do call them cosmetic surgeons.
But cosmetic surgeons.
But anyway, this is
That can happen on a small scale, and it can also happen on a large scale. Large scale kind of stuff is hiring James Spader from Boston Legal to talk about his love of Iron Chef. So now everybody who watches Boston Legal or listens to the podcast says, James Spader loves Iron Chef, and it makes them the next time they see Iron Chef is going to be on, or that they could record it with their TiVo, they think, oh, I'll do that. That's branding in the mass media sense. And so James holds a lot of influence that way. You might hire somebody who has that kind of stuff. And years ago, I wrote a piece on the idea of the online personality who built first a national following, but then decided to be a regional influencer who has a lot of contact with people about a specific set of products that he endorses. It's like talk radio in a lot of ways, too. Influence is it changes over time. It's not fixed. You can't say, I'm an influencer on all topics because I have a top blog. You're an influencer on specific topics. And if you aren't blogging about those topics at, you know, in a given time frame, you start to lose some influence, too. And I can show you how that happens. Statistically. So, and the other thing that will happen is that what we find as we look at these markets is that there are these postings, this kind of the what I call impacted information that just won't go away. It's the stuff that keeps getting referred back into the conversation by current participants. So if you're looking just for current talk about you, you're not really necessarily seeing who's influencing that, because there's a there was this really, I think it was a story in the Reader's Digest like in 1951, and it was about the fact that on Procter & Gamble products there was a satanic symbol, right? So this one article, which was wrong, which was just somebody, you know, thinking, talking out their ass, was, recited repeatedly for years afterwards and damaging the Procter & Gamble brand, because they're not a satanic organization. They aren't, you know, part of the Priory of Sion trying to – or anything. You know,
They were being portrayed that way.
And they'd always say – and there was this real – you know, it was a nationally published article. So that article was like a piece of impacted information that wouldn't go away. In a highly distributed market, there's many more opportunities for those kinds of, you know, one, two, three post series of ideas to suddenly become the evidence that people point at and drag back into every conversation they have. Because, my God, you know, Microsoft is, you know, serves the Dark Lord, Voldemort.
Yeah.
You know, and we have proof because look at this posting here where Bill Gates made a joke about Voldemort, and I'm being absurd. But the idea is that, you know, those stupid things can be of influence for years afterwards. And when we look at influence in discussions around brands and stuff like that, a lot of the times it's postings from 2002 or 2004
that keep being referred to, right? Yeah. But why is that happening? Is it because that posting fits along the thinking that person has and they're just trying to validate
that thinking?
Yeah, sometimes
that posting is like 2 or 3 degrees away.
Yeah.
But it's always there.
But are they looking for something new that maybe is evolved from that?
Well, people are looking for something new, and they're trying to talk about something new, but they may be saying, you know, they may be referring to a site that then makes reference to that site.
Mm-hmm.
And so that site is still out there shaping the conversation because it shaped this other posting.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can start to see that as you look at this, both longitudinally and in terms of what's currently being talked about.
So, you know, once you know that, how does that help a company or an individual?
A lot of ways. I mean, think about politics. If you could say, you know, there's this one posting that, you know, that defined George Bush as
or this one
fundamentally
statement or
bad,
this, yeah.
You know, let's go back and figure out how to actually deal with that question rather than arguing about it peripherally for the next 2 years. Let's go do it. We know what the real issue is instead of what people are. It's like the game of telephone that kids play where they start off with one version of a sentence, and by the time it goes around the room, it's completely mangled.
Mm-hmm.
You still have to go back to that one sentence in order to understand where the thing started.
Yeah, I think probably another good example of that is what happened in the presidential campaign with John Kerry, where he was portrayed as a flip-flopper,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the Swift boat thing. It was like, you know, that the Bush campaign used those little talking points out there across many mediums and had a significant influence on the
discussion. So what our tool can do is tell you you've got that problem. Then you have to use human intelligence to respond to it. There are a couple of ways that, you know, immediately come to mind. One is you can make sure you never refer to anything which makes reference to that problem when
mm-hmm.
you're talking.
Mm-hmm.
You only, in making links about John Kerry, write and publish links that point to his stalwart record of standing by particular issues. That would be one way to do it. Or you can go head-to-head with it and say, flip-flopper, George W. Bush flip-flopped on this, 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 and this, and this. So, but that's not something that I can tell you you should do one or the other. That's where you have to make a choice as campaign manager, marketer, brand manager, product manager, or otherwise. You know, and the other things that you might be doing with this kind of a system is looking at who the influencers are on a market and saying, you know, when we design the next version of our product, we want to talk to these people because they're the ones who are going to, you know, have already shaped what we're selling into.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about social media a little bit. And in the last few minutes here of the show this week, it seems like social media, at least my definition of social digital media might be a more correct thing, is the creation and sharing of social status and family and potential economic gains. It seems like that's becoming more significant these days. You know, you think about YouTube, you think about podcasting, people creating blogs. It's the content creation piece inputted in with social networking
mm-hmm.
that is really causing this whole thing to just explode online with people. And I think it dovetails back to what you were just talking about with influence, is that we're all becoming broadcasters. I mean, just like, you know, us doing this podcast right now, I mean, it's not listened to by a million people, but it's very much of a social medium. I mean, it's just like talk radio that's been on broadcast for years.
Mm-hmm.
It creates discussion and topics that hopefully have an impact on people's lives and the decisions that they make. But it just seems like we're moving into a whole other era of development.
The tools have gone from being exclusive and expensive to ubiquitous and democratic mm-hmm. or egalitarian. Anybody can do this. I think, you know, the other thing is that we can measure it. And mm-hmm. you talk about being able to share this value. Well, yeah. In the early world, there's this kind of, well, we're not really about, you know, making money and stuff like that. But what people are really talking about right now is that they know that if they start creating value, that value would be divvied up fairly, or mm-hmm. at least it can be based on the fact that you can track it. What I think you have to do, though, if you want to start creating that value as a project, mm-hmm. is find the purpose that the particular network can be applied to. Now, YouTube is really interesting, but it's also full of stuff that no one would find useful except as a novelty.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be funny.
Doesn't have a lot of meaning, is
right,
what you're saying.
It, yeah. And it has to be applied to something if you want to start converting it into value.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can put ads around it and say, well, if you play a whole lot of YouTube stuff and put ads in front of it, and whether anybody would accept that or not is totally unclear.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be a viable way of trying to turn YouTube into a business. But I don't see YouTube, because of its sort of we're about anything and everything, being particularly purposeful.
Yeah. And I think that leads back to our earlier discussion about having a more more meaningful social network that actually has some roots in actually discussing things and having an impact that are substantial, not necessarily just entertaining. And I guess that begs another question. It seems like that we're also moving very quickly towards being gravitated more towards entertainment things or sensational things or mm-hmm. celebrities. And it seems like such a distraction
what's really
important.
Would have called hot media.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it's such a distraction from what's really important in all of our lives.
Well, the thing is, what's really important in our lives is totally relative to what, you know, we're engaged with at the time.
Yeah.
If you're getting a real jingle out of, you know, watching Paris Hilton and her boyfriend on an illicit tape copy, then, you know, you're not thinking much about this month's bills.
No, and that's probably, you know, it's a form of escapism. I guess it's been around a long time. You think of movies and you think of other media it's entertainment, it's escapism, but I think what I'm concerned about is that society is moving too far in that direction, and that people are disengaging themselves from more important.
I worry less about that because Match.com and my mother-in-law. You know, I was on the board of Match.com when we had our 100th baby produced, and you know it was really weird to sit there and go, well, this month we had the 100th baby who was produced. That they actually wrote us a letter and said this was because we met on Match.com. That's a pretty fundamental need that we were serving.
Mm-hmm.
the need to be loved. I mean, we actually stayed away from the need to get hooked up business as much as possible. But you can see other kinds of purposefulness being introduced into lots of other networks today. You can see it in eBay, where it is just about creating small transactions. You can see it in the AdWords program around Google,
mm-hmm.
where you see small business and large business alike being placed in close proximity to relevant information. You can see it in the way that Yahoo is trying to create vertical channels around particular types of information. And you can see it in YouTube, Memorandum, in any number of these mashup sites that are combining different values. And values is both a relative, a cultural and a technical term in this sense, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. different data values.
There's different values and different data.
And allowing people to combine them and produce meaning. And the meaning is what is valuable. So I think that as we get past the initial novelty of, wow, I can – what's the thing that was on YouTube last week? It's the two guys lip syncing to My Hunt.
Oh yeah, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
So you see, the thing is, we saw that.
Oh yeah,
right?
Everybody sees it. Yeah.
So as we move past the novelty of the fact that we can communicate that way, it'll start to take on other purposeful values that will be imposed by the people doing the production who say, you know, okay, now that I've done my humps, what I really want to do is tell everybody that it's okay for me to be effeminate. Well, okay, now you've got a guy who's going to be, you know, creating a gay, lesbian, and bi community. And that's cool. I mean, I have no problem with their thing if that's what they want to do. So you're going to see that kind of stuff start to happen where communities coalesce around personality and performance, but you're also going to see substance added to that as just a natural fact of the interaction that goes on between the people around those early stars.
So is it like an online social networking maturity process? You think though what we're seeing here is that the more people that get involved in these communities kind of get sucked in because of the entertainment aspect and they get burned out of it and they want something more meaningful. And
well, you've seen that in podcasting already, Rob.
You kind of evolve into something more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's but there, you use the other word. It's not just maturing, it's evolving. So we're evolving constantly and maturing into what we've evolved into. So it's mm-hmm. a two-phase process that we're going through, and we're going through it incredibly rapidly. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had told somebody, I mean, there were people telling people this was going to happen, but if you'd said, oh, everybody will be able to put something on the internet and anybody will be able to watch it, so, in 1995, people would have said, what are you, nuts?
So do you think that happened from Friendster to MySpace, and then what's going to happen from MySpace forward? I mean, these new social networking sites like Gather, and so those are the ones that are going to be the ones that get traction.
You know what's going to get traction is that there'll be a lot of individual sites, but there'll be something that starts mm-hmm. mashing up those sites. Mm-hmm. And that's where that confrontation or meeting of differing opinions and values will come together, and we're really going to start to see interesting compromises and collaborations across communities. And that's where really transformational cultural and economic and political things will happen.
So, Mitch, are you saying that we're going to have cooperation with common logins across multiple communities? You think that's a possibility?
That's one thing that could happen. I know three or four different companies that are trying to do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not just that. I mean, it's how do you, you know, it's okay, maybe you have not common logins, but you have a avatar portability.
Okay. Well, that's the same. That's the same kind of thing, though.
Same kind of thing, but it's not about the login. It's about the look and the feel. So, if a Second Life character could walk into World of Warcraft, think about how that would change the relationship between those two sites. So, you know, it's a lot of different things, but the and the functionality will, you know, be on the ID layer. It'll be on the code portability layer. It'll be on transactional functionality across systems. There's a lot of things that are going to happen, but what happens when you actually get people together where they have to, you know, where there's a choice between creating greater value by collaborating or destroying value by fighting? I think that we're going to find, you know, there's always this bunch that wants to destroy value because they think, well, we'll come out on top. But I think a lot of people are also going to say, what are we kidding? We can make a better thing. We can all be wealthier or happier or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of, you know, big moments that we haven't even gotten close to yet. I there's an apocryphal story from back on, I think it was CompuServe, it might have been on one of the other early systems, where these two communities, one was a fundamentalist community and another was a gay community, and they mm-hmm. would raid one another's chat spaces and talk rudely to one another. And what happened one day was one of the rednecks mm-hmm. was saying, you know, you damn gays and rah, but I'd tell you more, but I got to go. My mother's in the hospital. She's got cancer. And he just said this offhand. One of the gay men said, you know, I'm sorry to hear that. My mother has cancer too. They started talking about their mother's cancer. And as a result, created a different level of communication between mm-hmm. those two communities. And there was greater tolerance. You know, people got along a little better because they recognized that it wasn't just about their views on these particular subjects. It was about the fact that there were some humans on the other side of the screen.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, Mitch, what do you think is, and Dana, let me know what you think about this too. It seems like, you know, when you talk about avatars, you talk about that basically screams out to me a common identity or an identity online. If you think about it today, none of us have a common identity online. I mean, you know, where you create an identity, and that identity can travel with you wherever you go online, okay? and it can carry with your friends. It can carry with you your logins. It can carry with you all the your profile information. It seems like that just like when the internet first started, there was the you know, everybody had to get a domain name. You know, so you had to create this registration. I'm wondering if that's the direction that we're ultimately going to, is where you create one identity and that identity is shared, where you can control the information that passes through that identity.
Well, I think it's not just identity, but pseudonymity. I can't say the word, but you know, you have multiple identities that you may use under different circumstances, and you're managing that.
That's true.
I mean, it's not just one identity.
Yeah, well, I mean, it could be one identity that you can have these offshoots from.
Right. So you've got two layers, though. There's, you know, I run into this all the time because, you know, I play fantasy baseball on three different systems, and in one case, I have more than the free number that I'm allowed, so I have two different identities on one of those systems. That's silly because now my statistics are fragmented across four different accounts on three different systems. It doesn't make any sense at all. Why don't those guys get together and try to, you know, create a common system where, like with Visa, you know, if everybody's playing, you get more value and you can compare league to league and, you know, player to player. But I don't think that I would want my identity, which is fairly transparent, to be carried over to if I were to log into OpenSpace and everybody knew that I was somebody's dad, because I would want them there to just think of me as another person and maybe find out that my daughter or my son was doing something really stupid.
Yeah.
If that was the reason. I mean, that's about the only reason I can think to be on there.
Yeah.
But the question of a common identity at this point is fragmented by perceived competitive issues that need to be overcome. And that's one of the areas where companies and nonprofit organizations need to get together and see that there's a greater common value in implementing that common identity framework before anybody out here, you know, the users are going to be able to start to forge the kinds of value that we're talking about
in their usage. Couldn't like an open source type of process be brought to bear on this?
It could, but then every system would have to write to accommodate that open source. So you still got you have a lot of political and technical.
So you would still have some fragmentation that would happen from that type of situation as
well. And fragmentation basically is a good thing from an evolutionary perspective.
Yeah. I mean,
forking is a great thing.
But if the core of it enables sharing,
right,
then it might work, but there could be slight differences.
Yeah. You'd also be able to solve lots of other problems like DRM if you had that kind of an identity structure.
So we just created a new company here?
I've got enough on my hands these days.
No, that's true. Well, Mitch, thanks for coming in again.
Well, thanks for having me. It was always fun.
It was great.
Great to be here.
It's always an interesting discussion.
Now that I know that I can get cosmetic surgery through connections here, I'll be back. You know?
Yeah, and I think we're going to wind up doing more regular shows now, I think. So.
Well, I hope so. My advice is not to talk about whether you're going to do more regular shows.
And then just do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like I said at the beginning, try not to do.
That's right.
No, not try not to do. Try not, comma, do.
That's right. Well, thanks. Well, thank you for joining us and listening to another Web Talk Radio show. We appreciate it. And come back and check out our website next week, and we'll have a new show up for you next week. We hope you have a great week, and we'll see you around the net.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check out webtalkradio.com for many, many more conversations about the future of the internet.